our new people. Would you raise your hands so we can see where you are, please? Raise them high, if you would. All the visitors today, the parents too. All right. What a lovely bunch of coconuts you are. And I see you brought your old trees with you, some of you young coconuts. You brought your mamas and daddies. They're getting ready to shake you. They're going to leave you here today by yourself. You're going to wave bye-bye to them as they drive off. You might as well get prepared for it. You can come to 406 East Center and cry on my shoulder, my wife's. But it's going to happen today, so get geared for it. We're sure glad that you're here. Every year, you're like a shot of adrenaline to me. I love you for what you do for me. That's selfish, I know. I love you for what you mean to me and to the church here. We're jealous over you. You're our children, and we want you to be a part of us. Next Sunday, we've got a great day ahead of us. Neil Pryor is going to be beginning our meeting at night on the Sunday evening at 4 o'clock. And if you've never heard Neil Pryor preach, you've missed something, but you've got it ahead of you this week or beginning next Sunday. Then we're going to have a picnic after the morning service out at Camp Wildwood. The fellowship committee is arranging it, and we want you to be our guests, and we'll announce the details of that next Sunday. And then we're going to go skating Sunday night after the evening service, about 7 o'clock. I'm the host of that, and we have a ball every year. This particular Sunday night, we go skating together and get to know each other. So all of that's happening next Sunday night and next Sunday at noon, and which will be just the beginning of a real good year. We're so thankful that you're going to be a part of it. About 2 or 3 weeks before my senior year began in college, my real good friend, Bob Plunkett, and I were on our way to Lenore, North Carolina to hold a meeting. And we drove all night long. And we had been so psyched up, people had told us there were wild bear and wild boar and wild deer. Everything else that was wild, we were told when you drive through those mountains of the Blue Ridge and Smoky Mountains, they said you never can tell what's going to jump out. Well, it made believers out of us. We had on the back seat a virtual arsenal. I had my Mauser. He had, a 30-06, and we had shotguns with plugs or slugs. No pellets. They were slugs. And we had all of that back there and just boxes of ammunition. If the police had stopped us, we'd have had a hard time explaining that we were two preachers going to hold a meeting. But those mountains, if you've never been in mountains at night, those things get fierce. They just seem like they tower all over you. And we were these two country boys, and we were driving, and sometimes you couldn't even see up to where the mountain began, and it was so dark. And every once in a while, you'd see a little mining town light stuck up in there, and it would just scare the daylights out of you. Well, we were just on edge. And we were so on edge that with all of this warning about the wild things that were ahead of us, I was driving at that particular time, about 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and Bob was over there asleep on the seat, and I looked up there, and sure enough, way up on the right, down in a ditch, these two huge eyes showed up. I said, "Bob, get up. It's here. There it is." He came up saying, "What is it? Where is it?" And he reached back and got his gun, loaded it finally. He stuck his thumb 2 or 3 times in there without the shell. And I stopped, and he got up on the hood of the car. He was brave. I wasn't going to do that. But he got up on the hood of the fender of that car with his gun cocked and ready to go, and I eased up to this thing. And sure enough, there it was. And it looked up, and it said, "Meow." It was a little old kitty cat about this big, but it had eyes like that. That was one of the most eventful trips I ever took. Not because of that, but a few hours later, maybe 2 hours later, around 5 or 5:30, something happened that just stunned us both. We were right up in the middle of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and day began to break on us. It began to dawn. We were so stunned that we just stopped the car and got out on one of those places where you can look out over the vastness of the earth. And we stood there and worshiped God as we saw this beautiful daybreak. I never will forget it as long as I live. What a beautiful experience that was. It didn't dawn on me at the time, as it has since, that God, in speaking about His coming into the lives of us humans, which is the ultimate human experience, He speaks of it as a daybreak. Back in Isaiah 9, the chapter where He introduces the fact that a son is born, a child is given, you know, and the government shall be upon His shoulders. He shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Prince of Peace, Everlasting Father. In that very chapter, He begins it by saying, "The people that walked in darkness saw a great light. And to them that sat in the regions of the shadows, or the deep darkness, to them did light shine." And then Malachi simply says that to those that fear Jehovah, the Son of Righteousness will arise with healings in His wings. I didn't realize that God's coming into our lives is spoken of as being a daybreak, a dawning. I also didn't realize how real to life that experience in the mountains was. I didn't know enough about life to know what it was. But you know, we go through many of our years in darkness. We go through our teenage years, for example, in darkness. Everything's kind of fuzzy. We don't really see things like they ought to be seen. We look at our parents like they didn't have good sense sometimes. We really do. You just think really that they're old fogies, and many times they just don't know what they're doing, and they haven't any right to be telling you what to do. We don't see things clearly. We're walking in darkness. And we're awfully defensive. We've got our back seats filled with this arsenal. We've got our guns loaded. We run from shadows. We run from kitty cats. And all of these things, you know, that loom over us that look so big as mountains in the dark, and there's just very little knowledge in us at those times. But if you'll hang on, I guarantee you, there'll be a daybreak if you'll just hang on. There'll be a daybreak provided one thing happens, and I'll mention that later, but there will be a daybreak. It's promised, and God has seen to it that there will come a time for a daybreak in our lives if you'll be open to it. There are many things and many ways we could discuss this experience. The experience of the daybreak in our lives. We could look at it historically. We could look at it as this song sang, the Son of Righteousness arising. And all of that has to be, or else there is no daybreak. But I want this morning, because there are so many 18-year-olds here today, and I say 18, maybe 17, the latter part, or maybe your early 19 year, but there are so many of us in that period of time, I would like to discuss with you for just a few moments some of the great daybreaks that take place in the life of an 18-year-old boy or girl. Well, you say, well, why 18? Well, I don't know, maybe. Part of it's environmental. Part of it is cultural. Our nation, the way we've set up our society, pushes us out into this crossroads at about the 18th marker. You leave home about 18. You go off to school. You go to work. You are pushed out of the nest, in a sense, when you're about 18. You cut the apron strings, and you try your wings. All of these things, the society in which we live seems to push us there when we're about 18 years old. And we're pushed into the world of adult decisions that you're going to have to make. And that's where you are today. You're coming into the world of adult decisions. But somebody says, oh, not here at Harding. Man, they don't leave any decisions till you hear all these rules and everything. No, that's not right. They leave the one real decision that really tests whether or not you're going to be mature. It really is left up to you. And that's simply this. How are you going to respond to authority that's over you? Benign authority, as that here, it's not unkind authority, but that decision really is left up to you. How do you respond to it? It's here. But let me tell you something, there isn't any place in the world where there's no authority. You're always going to be under authority. So the big decision, really, that you're being ushered into, that you're allowed to make, is how do you respond to it here? But how do you explain this that happens at the year 18? It may be just cultural. I doubt it. I think that it's developmental also. I believe that there are certain forces at work in you, such as your emotional development, your physical development, your social development, your spiritual development. I believe that about at the year 18, 17, 19, right in that area, there comes a heightening of those awarenesses to where you're pushed to a point of decision. Your road forks in life about at the 18th marker. And you're brought to a time when you either go one way or the other. You go to the right or to the left. And today, it's you who are at that point that I'd like to direct these remarks to. The Jew seemed to have reached it at about the age 20. You know all the times in the Old Testament when it talks about the ones that were 20 years old and upward? There was a classification of Jews at from 5 years old to 19. Then there was a classification from 20 on up to 60. Well, they broke it around, see, 19 or 20 was where they reached this crossing or this crisscrossing or the fork in the road. So we're pretty safe in saying that something happens about that time. Something happens about where you are. Now, what happens? You say, I'm all ears because I don't know what's happening. I'd like to know. Well, let me mention 4 simple things. Number one, one of the golden daybreaks of your life at about 18 is because of the things that happen, and you're being transported to different locations and all, and starting in a different site, a whole new page, a whole new leaf in your life is opened up to you. Brand new. Not a day of it's been lived yet. Nobody's marred it. Nobody's written on it. You haven't touched it yet. You're here with anticipation and expectations. And there it is. It's all brand new. White as a sheet, clean, pure. Your past isn't like that, is it? You've messed up your past pages. You've marred them. You've written on them. You've erased them. You've scuffed them. They look pretty messy, don't they? And you look back on your life in the past and think, can anything ever good come out of me? Well, let me say that one of the golden daybreaks is for you to realize that, you know, today is a new day. And I've got a whole new page, a whole new book ahead of me that never has been written in at all, not one page. It's waiting on you to write in it. You're kind of like Simon Peter. You remember the day that Jesus went down into the sea and Simon was there washing his nets? And Jesus urged him to get in the boat and put out into the deep and let his nets down. Peter said, Lord, I've fished all night long and I haven't caught a thing. Jesus said, I know, but let's go. Let your nets down out in the deep. Simon Peter told Jesus about a night of frustration. Peter knew nights, you know. He knew nights when he had put out those nets until he was just aching tired and come up with nothing tugging at it, nothing he could feel that there was nothing in it. But Jesus said, Peter, there's no use remaining the way you are. No man need remain the way he is. No woman need remain the way she is. And so he urged him to put his nets down, and so they did. And they pulled up such a catch of fish that they weren't able to contain it. And then Simon Peter's, the boat was filled with fish, and as the next boat was filled with fish, Simon fell on his knees amidst all those flopping fish, and it scared him. He said, Lord, get away from me. I'm a sinful man. Jesus then made this beautiful statement to him. He said, don't be afraid. From now on, you're going to catch men. And he used that expression, 2 expressions, don't be afraid, and from now on. They are 2 of the most beautiful expressions in the human language. No man, Jesus says to Simon, need remain the way he is. You need not remain unproductive. You need not remain a sinner. You can be productive and you can be saved from yourself if you will. And so here you come today. You're also aware of your dark nights. You've walked through many a night letting down your nets, wanting to make a catch and not making it. And you come here maybe empty as far as any achievements. You don't bring any achievements with you, really. Not any that really will count. And let me tell you, don't be depending on any, because the ones that you may have achieved back in high school, people don't want to hear about it. You may have come here with all these honors and all these ribbons. Well, keep them to yourself, because when you really weigh them, they're not all that much. You're just about like Simon Peter. But Jesus says to you, and what you've done now, he's saying, okay, let's go now. Put out from the shore, get out into the deep, and let's let your nets down for a draft. And you say, well, Lord, I've been trying for 15 years or 18 years, or I've been trying for the last 4 years of my life, and I've put out my nets and nothing's happened. He says, that's all right. Trust me and put your nets down out in the deep, and let's see what happens. And so you have. And you're in the boat, and you're looking around, you know, and you see all this that's beginning to happen, and it begins to scare you. You see all these fish, and all, you know, here you are, you're one, and you see all this around about you, and you look around and see all these people, and you think, uh-oh, where does that leave me? Jesus just simply comes to you and says, look, don't be afraid. From now on, you're going to be a fisher of men. Don't be afraid. From now on, you're going to be productive. Don't be afraid. Don't worry about your past. Don't worry about your emptiness. Don't worry about any of that. I'm going to take charge of you if you'll let me. And if you'll just simply trust me, I'll make you fishers of men. Remember this, will you? Today is the first day in the rest of your life. Today is the first day in the rest of your life. Well, you mean that means I have an opportunity then to make out of myself something different from what I was in the past. That's right. A new reputation is waiting on you. You know, like Simon, Jesus saw him coming. He said, Simon, so you're Simon Peter, or so you're Simon, the son of John. He said, you shall be called Cephas. Recognize him as what he was. But then he said, you shall become. You shall be known in the future as something different from what you were in the past. Not only is a new reputation waiting on you, a new character calls to you. I'm not all that interested in reputation, frankly. What I am interested in is a new character, and that's calling you too. New heights are calling you because new depths are calling you. Jesus called Peter to put out into the deep, and it's only in preparing a life in the depths that you really attain to the heights. And that's what you're having an opportunity. That's what's being presented to you today. A whole new page, a whole new horizon. And you don't have to remain the way you are. You can become something different. Well, okay, then a second realization that I think is a golden daybreak. It was in my life. And that is the day that I realized that after all, I was about like everybody else. After all, everybody else is about like me. I used to think that I was a nut. Really, I used to think that I had something loose in me. I thought, I'm the only one that feels like this. Boy, that'll drive you crazy. You'll get paranoid. I see some of you nodding your heads. Yeah, you know what I mean. Look, when it gets right down to it, you're about like everybody else. Can you accept that? Look, we all want to be accepted. We all want to be loved. We all want to be successful. Every last one of us. We all have feelings of insecurity. We all have feelings of inferiority. Everybody. We all have feelings of being untogether. We all have feelings of homesickness. There you go, as you mentioned. I didn't mean, forget it. You do. Somebody says, well, I don't have any feelings of homesickness for my home. Oh, but you do. Your only problem is that you can't find it and localize it and scratch it. Those that have a good home and are homesick, they can at least, they itch, but they know where to scratch. Those who don't have a good home and never have a good home and they don't know what it means, there's an aching that's all over you that you just don't really know where to touch and don't know where to scratch. But we all have those feelings. We all want to be received. We all want to have friends. We all want somebody to befriend us, but we're all a bit hesitant about being the one to take the initiative. Because we are fearful of rejection. We have all of these things about us. All of us at some time or other feel like this person who said, every time I get it all together, I forget where I put it. And that just about says it, doesn't it? Because we don't really have it together. And those that look like they do probably are just those that have a bit more skill at putting up a facade. Really? That may be all they've got ahead of you. They know how to cover up the loneliness and the emptiness and the homesickness and the feelings of insecurity and the want for love. You're just about like everybody else. Can you accept that fact? I guarantee you, if you can accept the fact that you're just about like everybody else, you're going to be so tickled. The day I realized that, I could hardly contain myself. I nearly went bananas. I thought, good grief, you mean I'm not a complete idiot? And I came to the conclusion, well, if I am, everybody else is too. And the feelings of guilt and the feelings of not knowing my relationships to the opposite sex or to my own sex or to my mom and daddy or to the church or to my family or to whatever it may be, I realized, well, you know, everybody else is about like that too. And then it dawned on me also, and God loves me in that condition. That was the real bomb. It exploded all over me that God loves me just like I am. He doesn't want me to be undone, but He didn't wait till I got it together to love me. When Paul said, we all once were foolish, that'll get 99% of us right there. We ourselves once were foolish, he says, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hated by men and hating one another. Whew, that just about will get all of us. Paul said, I was like that too. But then he said, but when the loving kindness of our God and Savior appeared, he saved us, not because of works done in righteousness, but in virtue of his own mercy. And then over in the Roman letter, he said that at just the right time, when we were helpless, Christ died for the ungodly. Well, he said, one will hardly die for a righteous man. Perhaps for a good man, someone might dare to die. But God commended his love to us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Can you accept the fact that you're just about like everybody else and that God loves you in spite of it? Oh, you say, I don't know whether I can accept that or not. Well, what else are you going to do? You say, this thing about the hairs of our head all being numbered, I don't know how to handle that. What's he doing counting the hairs on my head? And there'll be some of you that'll say, I know what he's doing. He's been breathing down my back all my life trying to catch me doing something. And here, that's why he can count the hairs on my head. But that's not the message that we get from the Bible. The message is that he can count the hairs on our head, not because he's looking down our neck, but because he's gently hovering over us to care for us. And he's that near us that he can actually count the hairs on our head. Which you going to accept? Well, I choose personally to accept what he's said here that has revealed him as the one who loves us that much that he's that concerned about us and not after in the sense that he's standing behind a tree waiting to zap us. Well, you're about like everybody else. But then once you've ever come to that conclusion, once you've come to the conclusion that you're about like everybody else, watch what it does for you. It opens you up and frees you to the dawning of a whole new raft of friends. Because, see, once you've learned to accept yourself, then you can accept other people. And there's no real tension. You don't feel inferior to anybody. You don't feel superior to anybody. You just feel this warm kinship to everybody because you look at them and say, you know, I understand what you're going through. I understand that because I'm like that too. And so it opens up just friendship after friendship after friendship. And while you're here, you've got the possibility of meeting your future mate. That's right. So make your associations as broad as you possibly can. Make them as deep as you will. But remember one thing. These relationships, many of them, will last as long as eternity. Bob Plunkett and I met at David Lipscomb College. He used to go to Harding when he was in high school. He went to the academy. He then came to David Lipscomb College. We met there. We'll be friends throughout eternity. There's nothing in the world that can ever happen to make Bob Plunkett and me not be friends. We've fished every creek and lake and pond around Nashville, Tennessee. when we should have been in class. If we weren't in class, they knew right where to go. Go up Lake Maribone, go over there on the left, and there's a bank over there where the brim are as big as your foot. And that's where they'll be. And they were about right. But anyway, those friendships that you're going to establish while you're here, they're going to be so valuable to you. Well, remember this. In order to have friends, you're going to have to be friendly. I went up to a woman's house about 2 months ago. I was going to the doctor, really, and her brother was coming out of the doctor's office. She was living upstairs over the doctor's office. And he said, come with me, I want you to meet my sister. She was about 65. And so I did. I went in, he knocked on the door, and she said, oh, I'm not ready to receive guests. I didn't see her, but he opened the door, and she said that to him. So I didn't go in. She stood there at the door and talked. Really, she wanted me to come in, but I didn't go. I didn't really think she wanted me until later on she wrote me a letter. And she says, I don't have many friends. She says, I don't get out much. I just don't seem to have many friends. I wrote my father a letter who lives in the same town. I wrote him a letter and said, would you go by and see this woman? And I put her letter in there for him to read. And he called me long distance. He said, Jim, we have for years been trying to befriend this woman. But he said, she won't let you. But he said, we're going to try again. But then he made this very wise statement. If you would have friends, you'll have to prove yourself to be friendly. So if you'll just let your associations be wide and let them be deep, then they'll develop into such that they're going to be long as eternity. You'll be opened up because you're not threatened by anybody. You realize that they're just about like you, and it's going to just open doors for friends after friends. But then there's a fourth thing. Having been ushered into such a friendly surrounding as this, where you recognize that you've got a whole new life ahead of you, where you recognize that really you're just about like everybody else, and where you realize, by the way, there's material here for friendships that'll be eternal, having been ushered into such surroundings as that, you're going to find yourself opened up to a whole new horizon of learning, of knowledge. Academic knowledge, that's right. Jesus, though, said, the freedom that comes from knowledge, you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. That's a beautiful statement. It has dimensions and qualities about it that are recognized by people, whether they're believers or not. The truth always sets people free. Any kind of truth. A truth about science, truth about history, truth about anything. It'll give you an ensuing freedom that just lets you stand up and understand who you are and where you're going. Freedom just simply from the knowledge of truth. But that's not what he was referring to, really. He prefaced that in verse 31 of John 8 by saying, if you abide in my word, then you're truly my disciples, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. He referred to himself as being that which really and truly gives freedom. He referred to himself as being the truth in John 14. I am the way, the truth. And he says, now if you'll abide in me and abide in my word and let it abide in you, you'll know the truth, and the truth will make you free. May I say this to you today, you freshmen? May I urge you to be aware and to beware of something? Don't let the fact that you have to take Bible here for credit, don't let that cause you to miss the point, will you? You're going to be required to take Bible for credit. One young man who went all through the academy in Memphis, came here for 4 years, took Bible every day that he was in the academy and here, 16 years of it. He didn't recognize until he got out that he had been studying his Bible courses just like he studied his science courses. He forgot what Christian education was about. And let me say this also, those of you who go through the line to be counseled, don't let the counselor tell you, oh, well, let's just this one on the life of Christ, this course on the life of Christ and his teachings, that's a lower level course. We'll skip that and go up to an upper level course and give you that. It'll give you more credit in the upper level. If any counselor tells you that, look him right in the eye and say, Mister or ma'am, you must have forgotten what Christian education is about. I'm here to learn about Jesus Christ. I don't care if it's no level. upper, lower, whatever. I want to learn about Jesus Christ. And if you'll do that, your academic learning, even academic learning about Christ, will be meaningful. But it's not just academics that this church wants you to be a part of. We want you to possess experiential learning, experiential knowledge. What do you mean by that? Simply this. We want to do for you what Christ would do for you. We want you, when you leave here, to be able to go out of this place from among us having experienced what Christianity is really all about. We don't want you just to study about it. We don't want you to be told about it. We want you to experience the reality of what Christ means as he is applied to you through the loving hands and the kind care of people who are followers of Christ. That's why we're going to have that picnic next Sunday. We want you to be a part of a fellowship. That's why we're going to have the meeting. We want you to be a part of an instruction fellowship. That's why we're going to do a lot of things that we're going to do all this year. So we come to some daybreaks in your life as an 18-year-old or a 19, or it may be that you're a bit slow like me, and it may take you a little bit longer. All of this is conditional. It's conditional on whether or not you believe that Jesus is the Christ. I believe personally that Jesus from Nazareth, the Jew, I believe that he is the light of the world. I've put him to every test I know. I believe what John said about him, that in him was life, and the life was the light of the world. I believe what he said about himself when he said, I am the light of the world. He that follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. You asked me this morning, if you would, I would like to answer you. You asked me, Jim, do you really believe that Jesus is what he claims to be? Let me tell you from the bottom of my heart, yeah, I do. I really do. I've considered other options, but I've been driven each time right back to him, and yeah, I believe it. I believe God visited our earth in the person of Jesus Christ. Well, you say, well, when did this begin to dawn on you? When I was about 18. Just about when I was about 18. And let me tell you, it's been one continuing, increasing golden daybreak ever since. He's where it's at. So here's your daybreak. Here's the dawning of your new day. Don't miss it. This is your time of life. This is for you, and this is what God has planned for you. We want to sing a song of encouragement to you. We want to urge you to come. Whatever may be your needs, if you have a real need to come and say, look, I believe that and I want to do something about it, I don't quite know what I want to do, if you want to do that, come and we'll counsel with you. We'll talk about it and talk to you. Whatever may be your needs, we urge you to come right now while we stand and sing.